I'm joining the podcast, someone that people may have not heard from in a little while, and I'm proud to have them on the episode because it's taken almost a year to get them on here. Tony Lopez from the band Christovox. Tony, thank you for joining the show.
I'm glad to be here, man.
A lot of people ask about you guys, you know, and not really much has been put out. You guys had the documentary video, which was really cool to watch. The first time I watched that quite a while back, you know, I honestly wasn't familiar with Christovox during that time period. I was into all those bands, and it was nice to discover you guys. And that's how I did discover you guys, because of that documentary. And then went back and started listening to your music. And now to have you on the show, it is an honor, because you guys put out two albums, but they were really, really good albums. They're good material. You guys were talented musicians. And of course, I want to discuss Before Christovox with you, but also that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I totally can appreciate that the music connected with you. That's fantastic.
And going back, you know, obviously the questions, you know, it's generic questions I ask my guests, but when did you really start getting into music? Who were you getting into? What bands were you loving that started influencing you?
It's hard to really pinpoint the genesis of it. I think obviously, we're the creations of a creator that is music. I mean, just literally the heart of what music is. So I think that's certainly a part of each one of us. For me, I think the real, the connection with music started with one of two events. One is just recognizing that I had a cousin, Ben Lopez. And he played guitar and he was really good. He used to sing and, I used to love the sound of his voice. But what amazed me is, you hear music on the radio and, music for me at that point was this production entity, which was disconnected. I had no idea how you made it. It was just on the radio. I mean, it was just, growing up, the only thing I heard were the types of bands that my dad played on his reel to reel, which was either classical, Beethoven, Bach, or the Beatles. That was essentially, the sum total of my musical education at that point. So anyways, when my cousin Ben would play guitar, it just amazed me that this human could actually create this thing that I heard on the radio by himself. He's sitting there with a guitar, he's singing it as a one-man band. And to me, that just struck me as, kind of awe-inspiring. So I was inspired by that. And then also, I remember at around the same time going to a wedding, the first time I'd ever been to a wedding as a young child, and there was a live band. And I just remember the feeling of having the bass drum just resound in your chest, that thumping, that I don't know if it was the power, or just the way that, the connection between the physical and the audio vibrations. It was just kind of something that impacted me. So I know that there was something that I wanted to be more involved with, was just being a part of that whole visceral experience.
What was your first concert that you got to go see that mattered to you?
Well, I don't really recall what the exact first was. The first one that I remember, and the one that I'm pretty sure was the very first one, was I went to go see a band that I was not excited to go see about. my buddy wanted to go see the singer from a band that I did not like, which was Black Sabbath.
Really?
Ozzy Osbourne had this new band. It was like 1981 New Year's Eve, and it was the LA Forum. And he had a new guitar player that I'd never heard of. I was like, well, he's supposed to be good, so we'll go check him out. So we went to go check it out. And that was, of course, Randy Rhoads.
Randy, yeah.
That was actually a life-changing experience.
Were you, how old were you when you went to see them?
Let's see, that would be 15.
So were you already playing guitar at that point?
I was. I started playing guitar just as a result of my mother used to go visit her mother, mm-hmm. who lived in the same city regularly. So as we went over there, usually I would tag along and have nothing to do as they sit there and had their conversations. So I would be left to my own devices. And one time I was just rummaging through a closet, and I found an old abandoned acoustic guitar that belonged to my Aunt Mary. So I just entertained myself with that. I didn't have any lessons or know what to do with it, but it was kind of fun discovering. There was no preconceived notions of what I was supposed to do with it. It was just like, hey, you hit the string and it makes a sound, and then you put your finger over here and it makes a different sound. So you just kind of played with it, explored, and figured out what you can do with it.
Yeah, I was wondering, after you saw that concert, did Randy become an influence for you, or were you amazed at watching that?
Yeah, I mean, up until that point, my only musical influence that I really cared to not really emulate. I never really tried to copy the material, but I think most of my influences more come along the line of inspiration, the way that they kind of connect with you on the emotional level, the kind of imagery that, you know, they can create with the notes, with the, you know, the themes, you know, the drama of it, I think. And just the way it kind of supports the song, you know. Ultimately, I love songs. I love the way that songs kind of, you know, connect with the human spirit, and then music, every instrument plays a part in either supporting or detracting from that message or that overall form of communication. So that's kind of what makes it such a powerful thing, is that it reaches us so many different levels, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually.
What's a song that's kind of off the wall, because you just made me think, and I'm always curious what other people think about this, because I know what my answers are, but what are some songs that you think are just probably the greatest written songs ever? You could listen to it the rest of your life over and over, never get sick. So for instance, one of mine is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Never gets old.
Yeah.
But one of the best songs, beautiful song. And then I could be a weirdo and say one of the other ones is Come On Eileen by Dexy's Midnight Runners. I love that song. Just something about that song. So what are those songs for you? Are there any songs that you could pick?
Not really one. I mean, it's almost like it's like having a favorite child. It's like, you know, there's always a thousand others that you want to put in that list. And this becomes kind of like this long exercise and naming all these songs that probably everybody knows. I just think that most, you know, because I was really into that whole Led Zeppelin thing, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, pretty much everything they did was inspiring to me. And Aerosmith, Queen, certainly. I think those are kind of the main bands that I listened to at that point. And then when Ozzy came along, I wasn't really into the heavy metal thing really much. You know, or at least what they called like the new wave of heavy metal, and earlier, prior around that time, it was like, you know, bands like Judas Priest and Scorpions, and I got involved with that later. But at that time, that was kind of like the newest. You know, Randy kind of was an innovator in that. So he certainly wasn't the first. I mean, Eddie Van Halen obviously had a earlier and a powerful influence on guitar players, but musically, Randy was the one that I connected with. You know, I wasn't something that Eddie Van Halen, as great as he was, and as much as we all owe him for what he brought, I didn't connect with that music on an emotional level, so didn't listen to it much.
I was going to ask you, did you grow up in California?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and I lived there until 1986, where I moved to San Diego, and I lived there until last year.
Oh wow, okay. Well, I didn't realize you're from LA. I knew when you read the band's information for Chris Fox that you guys were out of San Diego. So
absolutely.
You growing up in LA, especially in that prime time right there, were you able to go to a lot of those places that, you know, the Rainbow, Roxy or whatever, or Troubadour, all those places that people talk about, you know, those famous places? Did you get to go see shows, or was that something you didn't really venture to, or?
No, that was a part of my life, you know, prior to, you know, to meeting Jesus. It was just, that's what we kind of did regularly whenever we could scrounge up enough money to pay for gas to get up to Hollywood and you know, and get us in the door someplace.
Yeah.
Sorry. Rainbow, Troubadour, and some other places that I didn't remember. I think Troubadour was a place that we preferred most, just because the vibe of, you know, the bands that would play there, you know, the accessibility. And
were there any shows that stick out that you got to see, like bands before they really broke, that you remember?
A lot of bands playing at that time that I, you know, I don't always, again, because of what I was doing at the time, there's a lot of stuff I don't remember.
Yeah.
You know, Guns N' Roses playing there a lot. You know, Janie Lane was playing in a band called Plain Jane before he did Warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Poison was playing out there, and believe it or not, I mean, I wasn't a huge Poison fan as far as that really kind of melodic poppy kind of thing, but in the earlier days they actually put on some great shows. They had a different guitar player before CeCe. Can't remember, he left the band to go back to the Midwest and I think do a different life, but he was a really fantastic guitar player, and they had some, you know, great songs that they had written. Um I think Motley Crue had already kind of come gone, you know, and left at that point in time. But there was a lot of upcoming bands, and you know,
Were
Army,
you
same
from, even though you said you weren't a Christian yet, were you familiar with bands like Stryper at all during that time or getting to see them?
thing. No, actually, I was not. But I do remember the first time I'd ever heard the term Christian metal was standing in front of the Rainbow,
Oh, really?
and I was just privy to a conversation that was happening, you know, as people kind of like, you know, in between shows, they go outside and they have a smoke or just socialize or whatever. So we're out there on the front of the Troubadour or the Rainbow, one of those places. And I heard this guy talking to another guy, and he was saying, he's like, yeah, there's this band called Stryper and it's Christian metal, which they felt was a complete oxymoron since in their mind, you know, metal is everything evil and Christian was, you know, the antithesis of that. So they found that just to be an oxymoron. And I found that kind of humorous because I had no exposure, you know, to anything as far as Christian rock. So, and it wasn't until probably a year or two later that I ever heard the name Stryper again.
I was gonna say, you kind of mentioned that there about a year later. When do you, was it after you become saved that you start becoming familiar with this Christian metal? Is that when that kind of happens later?
Well, the way that kind of happened is my life was under my own direction. I did what I wanted when I felt like it. So I wasn't at that point, you know, really paying any attention to God. And my choices led to the consequences of ending myself in some, you know, what do you call them? Correctional institutions. A couple times, and then the second time around, it was kind of the point where I started recognizing that my decision making process wasn't really the best, and started looking for alternative ways of directing my life. I had a friend of mine who used to come over, and we used to drink together. And he, even though he was drinking with me and drinking a lot, he would share the gospel and he would tell me about Jesus. So it was at that point that I had my initial exposure, you know, from a peer telling me about his experience. And things that had changed in our relationship, you know, quite a bit before and after that. But at the point where I found myself in jail, I thought about what he was saying, and I kind of decided that I was going to reach out and ask God. It's like, you know, if you are real, because I wasn't really convinced that he even existed, but I was hoping that he was. So I just said, if you're real, you know, you can hear me, and I need you to kind of connect with me in a way that I can see you and understand and perceive you. And I figure, you know, if he doesn't, then I don't have anything to worry about because nothing's going to happen. And if he is, then well, let's see what transpires.
When did you have that feeling, though? Obviously, we became a Christian. Was what felt like it connected, or how did that happen?
Well, it was a jailhouse confession. I mean, you know, people say those don't last, but you know, here we are, you know, I don't know,
Or
36.
like when you're hitting turbulence in a plane real bad.
Yeah, right. You're
You're like,
saying
God, help. I'll do whatever you
awesome.
want.
No, I was literally in the, you know, San Bernardino County Jail, and I was I really wanted God to be there because I just felt this sense of isolation and disconnectedness from the world. And I don't know how the conversation come up, but I couldn't see my cellmate or the person in the next cell over, but we ended up talking just to have some conversation. And I discovered that he had a Bible. And again, I have how this conversation came up, I don't remember at all. But I remember I really wanted the Bible. And he says, well, what do you got to trade? And I said, I've got nothing but a pack of cigarettes. And he said, deal. So I traded a Bible for a pack of cigarettes. And I read it that night. And then the next day, when I was finally released, I decided I need to go find a church and find out what this thing's about. So I went to a couple of churches. One, the first church I went to was actually Crenshaw Christian Center in was it Englewood or Crenshaw area, and that was an interesting experience. But it wasn't not long after that I was invited to go to a church that my brother Eddie was going to called Sanctuary, and then that was a weird thing. You know, it was like all these, you know, Christian
Rocker
rockers.
guys and pastor, was Pastor Bob out there? Was he the lead pastor at that point there?
Steve Valdez, but well, I mean, actually how that lead pastor thing, the title, I don't know if anybody really cared, but Pastor Bob was out there, and Steve Valdez was the one who I, you know, typically would see. So yeah.
About how old were you when this transition happens? Were you still pretty young?
Yeah, let's see. So I'm guessing somewhere around 19 or 20.
Okay. And at that point, with, I guess, things going on in your life where you were in and out of trouble, I guess, in a way, but was music even a factor in your life at this point with playing guitar or trying to perform
Yeah,
or
at that
anything?
point, yeah, certainly. I was, you know, I had dreams of wanting to play. I don't know what my dreams were really centered around. I think they were less about being in the limelight and more about being able to do that for a living all day long, every day, you know, and maybe even get to, you know, travel the country. That just seemed like the ideal life right there.
What was your first real guitar that you were able to purchase, or someone, I don't know, parents purchased, whoever purchased it for you though?
Well, the first guitar I had was that, you know, it's a that proverbial story about a nylon string classical guitar, which it was a Tisco, T-I-E-S-C-O, that belonged to my aunt. That's the one I found in the closet at my grandmother's house. It didn't play very well, but it's, you know, I didn't have anything compared to it. No complaint at that point. But after playing for a while, I just immediately decided I wanted to have a real electric guitar. A friend of mine, David Coburn, yeah, he was a classmate, and he had a Guild S300D, kind of an unusual guitar, dual humbucks, one piece body made out of kind of a heavy mahogany. So I'd go over and play that, and it was just an all the instrument. And it turns out that the local music store, Calvano's, there in Southgate, California, had a similar one. It was white. That I thought was kind of cool looking. And I didn't, you know, I couldn't tell you what a good guitar between a bad one, but that one I thought.
I just jumping ahead to ask about that question. So when you're with Christ Fox, what kind of gear or guitars also did you play with, or did you want to play with, or what were you kind of using at that time?
I only had that same white guitar that I bought when I was
Oh,
younger.
really?
Person I bought, which is basically you know, the culmination of saving paper route, birthday money, any money I got for Christmas, and then my mom. So somebody actually tried to steal that guitar from the music store. They pulled it through the window through the broken glass and scraped the paint up. So when they got the guitar back, they put it on sale as damaged. And I said, well, I don't care. I bought it.
So that guitar you played throughout the career of Christ Vox then?
Well, I played that up until that point. So it was a hardtail. There was no, you know, tremolo arm. And as of where Christ Vox had originated, because obviously they were together and writing songs before I ever became, you know, came into the picture. And their previous guitar players had written some of the material, you know, utilizing very prominently, a tremolo whammy bar, whatever you want to call it. So I just said, well, if I'm going to, you know, play some of the songs as they were, I need to get one of those and learn how to use it. So I think it was, I don't know where it came from first. Matt Lane, who was a friend of the band, he had let me borrow his guitar. And so I used that, and eventually I ended up buying an Ibanez, like an RG550 or something like that, you know.
Okay.
I don't know, so those are the main guitars I use. But the one that Matt brought actually turned out to be my favorite one. That was in like a 1984 Kramer Pacer, like this kind of like neon blue with a, you know, black hardware and gray sharp. It sounded great, felt great. So I used that and preferred that over every other guitar.
Is Kramer still around? I mean, I know they're a company, or I mean, people play them, but I'm curious because that's a name you don't hear too often.
I think they are. So many of the guitar companies now they have the same name, but
yeah, exactly.
Some corporate iteration.
Yeah, someone bought somebody and still keep the name, so it's weird. But so you go going back, you're going to the Sanctuary Church. When does music, Christian music, when do you make that decision, or is that a decision that you make that, hey, I want to pursue doing music, but it's going to be Christian, or it's going to be about this? How does that kind of work out for you?
It was weird and intimidating. So coming into that sanctuary, you know, first of all, it's a complete transformation of my lifestyle. It wasn't so much like I felt I had to be a good person. It was just, you know, I think when, you know, when the Spirit of God grabs hold of you, it makes you want to have a different outcome. You're not trying to be good. You're trying to have a relationship. And in that process of pursuing God, you're leaving behind those things that get in the way. And that's really where I was. I was, you know, I had issues with alcohol and other substances, which kind of fortunately got out of my way as I was making that pursuit. So music was one of the things I was really passionate about, but I didn't want to get ahead of myself and kind of presume that this is what I was supposed to be doing, because I really didn't know. I mean, I certainly wanted to, but I didn't have that confirmation that it's like, this is really what I needed to be doing with my whatever days I had at that point. So, and in Sanctuary, it seemed like everybody, you know, when you sat down in a pew, there's probably like 20, 30 bands represented at any given
right
day. Like up on the stage, you know, we had Jim Laverty and Baron Cross. You know, some of the guys from Striper used to go there, I think prior to, you know, when I was started, you know, attending there. And there was a lot of other bands that I actually don't, you know, Eternal Right, Neon Cross, Holy Soldier, mm-hmm. you know, those were all the people that were attending that fellowship at that time.
Yeah.
More that I don't remember.
What is going on musically with you before you do get into Christovox? Were you playing with anybody else or?
No, I was, well, I mean, I, you know, back when I lived in LA, I played you know, backyard party bands.
Yeah.
You know, original material, just all, you know, covers of Judas Priest, Scorpions and Deep Purple. You know, funny story. It was just a weird genesis. When I was living in LA, we practiced on the corner of a Hill Street where our drummer Benny used to live. And we used to practice. And then after practice, he was always get up and he'd, you know, he'd go to some other friend's house down the street, like, you know, about four or five houses down. And he'd go over there to harass like what he called the competitor band. I didn't know who the guys were because I didn't live there. But it turns out it was a Slayer. They used to practice about a couple of houses.
Oh.
So I guess he was neighbors with one of the guys who lived there or
something. That's interesting. What a time back then before you knew all these bands blew up and who they would become and just that culture, that area of all those guys being there too.
Yeah, but, LA was a hotbed of just all kinds of new music. I mean, for quite a while, for multiple genres, going from the punk to the rock, and I mean, obviously going from the rock of the 60s and 70s, and you know, Hollywood was obviously just kind of like a breeding ground for all the various musicians, kind of like New York and Nashville and Austin.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny how things are totally different now these days with that area where it's nowhere like it was. But I was going to ask you, what does lead you to Christovox? How does that happen? Are those guys, like you said, they're in San Diego, correct? Or right. Were they, I mean, how do you even hook up with those guys being hours away?
Well, it came to the time of when that actually happened. There was a couple of things that transpired. One was I had a friend who invited me to go to church in San Diego, and it was such a different experience. It wasn't really the kind of the traditional building-based church. It was just a, you know, they called church the people who met together, and wherever they happen to meet is where they happen to meet. That wasn't the church. So that, to me, that was kind of a novel concept, kind of the inverse of what I thought it was. So I started going to a home-based church up there and got really connected with the people and got to know people. And I guess the accountability, the encouragement that you find by knowing people and spending time with them throughout the week and not just on Sundays. So eventually I just felt that God was calling me to actually move to San Diego. So I tried to figure out a way to get up there. I was praying about it. And there was a band, before Recon, it was Duroc. And actually, George Ochoa, and I'm sure you know George.
Yeah, I've had him on the show.
Steve Martinez, I think he went by the name Steve Duroc. And anyway, Steve was in the construction industry, and I was trying to save up money to figure out a way to move to San Diego. So he gave me a job working with him graciously. And then, as I was trying to get some money, I was spending all my money driving back and forth from where I lived in LA to up in that area. So then he invited me to go live in his house for a while so I can actually save some money, trying to make that happen. So that was fantastic. His family was very gracious. So anyways, I ended up moving to San Diego, and I lived there ever since. But it was once I kind of got established in San Diego that I just talked to Fred the other night, and he doesn't remember exactly how it happened. I wasn't there, but they said they were at a church somewhere, and somebody mentioned, hey, I know a guitar player named Tony Lopez. And because they had just lost their guitar player, they had some label interest. They called me up and said, hey, would I be interested? And And I don't remember exactly how it happened, but I do recall maybe three or four times I just told them, no, I'm not interested. I just didn't think that was what was for me at that time. And they persisted for whatever reason, not because they'd never heard me play. So they had no idea. I think it was such a lack of guitar players available.
Yeah.
We played rock and we're Christian at that time that it's like, you know, we don't have any options. They kept on calling. So I'm grateful they did. Eventually I just said, you know, just, all right, I'll go up there and we'll, you know, play and check each other out as far as what we like music wise. So they invited me up to their place up there in El Cajon and brought a guitar and amplifier, and they just, you know, played some of the songs, and I thought they were great. I love their lyrical content. I like their energy, you know, great bunch of guys. And they just said, well, here's your homework assignment. You know, here's a couple songs, write some guitar solos. We'll come back, you know, next week and let's see how it pans out. So I wrote some solos for, I think, maybe Power Games or something like that. And they came back and they said, let's do it. So we did it.
After you joined the band, you guys recorded demo. I know there's a demo record, but was that before you? I think it's called Wear It Out.
The demo that I saw, was it accompanying with a video?
That I don't know. I saw that there was
Tough Boys, and that's the only video that I saw. They did with their other guitar player, a guy named Monty. He's a good guitar player, but I think he just had a different direction he wanted to go with his life, so that didn't pan out. And but there was, you know, that was the only song that I was aware of, and then all the other songs they provided to me through, like, you know, demo tapes that they had just, you know, done themselves.
Are you guys, once you're in the band, I know you said they were already kind of being approached by record labels. Was the first album, was that on Regency Records?
Yeah.
Okay. Were there other labels out there that you guys were talking to? How'd you guys wind up going to Regency Records?
I don't know if you know Adam. Adam is a super capable, very smart guy. So he really handled, he and Lauren and Fred. I mean, actually, I don't even how they divvy that up.
Adam's the lead vocalist, correct?
The lead vocalist. He did a great job.
And Fred's the drummer. Okay.
The conversations and working out the logistical aspects of the label. I had very little to do. I was really naive when it came to how it all worked. And I actually had a little interest.
Mm-hmm.
How it works. So it was like, I was, you know, my little world was being able to play the songs, you know, write some parts. And I started working on writing some songs. And, you know, that was really all that I was interested in that point in time. You know, we got an opportunity to play our music and share with the, you know, people. And that was really the extent of my ambition. But Adam was really good at that, you know, the administrative logistical side. So he and Lauren and Fred kind of took care of the rest of that. And so with, you know, at that time, Regency was kind of like a small label. I think it was headed by David Malmy and Wendy Dykhuizen, who worked with David, and they kind of made all open for their first record. And, you know, we had some success with the first album, and then it ended up kind of like rolling over, being sold to another record company. And they had their own, you know, Ocean Records, and they had their own.
Was the label sold to them, or the band was sold to the other label later?
You know, how that worked exactly, it was
more not really sure.
Like I felt like it was just the band, you know, the content, future of that.
When you guys signed with Regency, was there a certain album, I guess, number that you guys were supposed to do, or you signed like a 3-album deal or anything like that? Or
no, I don't think so. There could have been, but as I said, I had such little injury.
Yeah, Adam might be the one.
I would just sign it, and yeah, I have no idea what it said.
Well, so when you guys sign with Regency, how soon do you guys go into the studio? I mean, where do you tell me about the experience of going? Because it is a small label. It's not really a big label. It's probably providing a ton of money. But you guys go into a studio. Who's producing? How's that working out for you?
Well, the first album was produced by Adam and Lauren and Fred.
Okay.
Or maybe it was Adam and Lauren, or but they had more experience working in the production world. You know, Lauren had worked as a recording engineer, and you know, they'd all kind of worked on their demos for quite a while. So this was not new to them. It was certainly new to me. I actually, so let me actually step back here. And you said, how did this kind of happen? Where did we go to? Well, first of all, being the last guy to join, To me, it was like a world. It seemed like I just joined, and it was it seemed like a matter of days or weeks before the conversation about doing a record kind of popped up. They had been working on it obviously for a while, but it's like, I guess the final piece was having, completing the band, having the material kind of wrapped up and then ready to record it. So it didn't take very long before they kind of worked out the details that we were going to record in a local studio that I actually worked next door to as an electronic repair technician, which is what I was doing at the time.
Okay.
And so it was Studio Masters. Yeah, I was there in San Diego. That we recorded the first album. There was no externally hired producer. It was done by, primarily Lauren and Adam. We recorded it there. I'm trying to think what else happened.
Well, I was going to ask you this. How many songs were already written before you came in the band that winds up on the first album? And what were you able to contribute, maybe song-wise, or were you able to for that first album with your songs?
Everything was written. Most
okay.
The songs that I would contribute to are songs that I, playing around with for a while. I brought Sacrifice. I'd written the musical aspect. Adam
okay.
wrote all lyrics, regardless of what I'd contributed musically. Adam was still the one who's doing.
And that'd be your lead off track for that album too, Sacrifice.
Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
And then Adam was talking, or somebody was talking about, hey, it'd be cool to have a nice acoustic song, to do, as we were having these explorative discussions, and I said, well, I've got something I've been working on, and I played Home Again for him, and then Adam heard it and disconnected. It's like, I've got it, so he disappeared, he went to his filing cabinets, he thought of some lyrics he thought would be a good match, he came back, and the way I remember it, and maybe it's not accurate, but I remember that we got through most of that song, really the first pass. I just started playing the verse that I knew that I'd written up at that point, the introduction, he started singing, and I was like, I got the goosebumps. I loved his delivery and where he matched it. And then, we finished off the song with, bits on the chorus and some other things and writing a solo, but most of that song seemed like it got kind of just ironed out there on the spot.
Yeah, that's cool how you guys could mesh so easily with some of that stuff,
I pointed out that Adam's super well organized, so he has a filing cabinet probably of hundreds and hundreds of songs ready to go that he'd written, filed, and somehow remembered existed.
Were there any songs that you guys didn't wind up recording that just kind of were left behind, never or could have been used on the second album, but or did you guys record exactly what you went in there to record and that was it?
That part's fuzzy. I don't remember any songs that we worked on and didn't make it, but it's very possible. I mean, Lauren was very prolific in writing, so he could have had a lot of those songs that were either in its genesis or already completed by that first album that didn't get on the first album that he, saved and reworked or brought back for the second. But I couldn't tell you.
I was going to ask you then, after the album, self-titled album, is released, what do you guys do? Are you able to go do any kind of shows? I know touring is a difficult thing, especially being on a small label and not really something you can probably finance yourself. Did you guys hook up with any other bands to tour with? What's happening? What's the reception like also?
I think touring would be, not very accurate. We found gigs to play, despite it was very interesting. I mean, we were able to do the album, so we certainly had a calling, business card to say, hey, we've got some ability to pull off a concert. But we did concerts here in San Diego. We did set up in Hemet. We played at some of the Calvary Chapel churches, which are great opportunities to share our music. And then eventually we got, 91, got to do the Cornerstone gig out there in Bushnell, Illinois. That was great fun. Got to play with Guardian up on the same stage, a little tent in the back. And hang out with those guys. Fantastic. Tony Palacios, an amazing guitar player, and Jamie Rose, fantastic singer. So they were fun.
In the meantime, I'm guessing you guys are all probably having to work regular jobs and, because this Krista Vox is probably not paying millions of dollars. as a kid would probably look at it and think, man, I bet those guys are rich rock stars. Not really.
Yeah, it's funny. as a You know, as a music fan, I know a lot of my bands, you just assumed that they were like, you know, had enough money to do whatever they wanted.
All
And
right.
some of the bands that you listen to were still doing, you know, regular day gigs like
Yep.
everybody else. And we were, I mean, we didn't make any money at all. I mean, I didn't make any money from any of the recordings or any of that stuff myself. So yeah, I you know, worked, you know, as electronic technician, you know, for the entire time, except for a few weeks while we were recording. I was got in between jobs because I just like I couldn't get weeks off in order to do the recording schedule. So I think I ended up quitting my job, and then by the time we finished the album, went looking for another one.
Also, you know, the first album comes out right 1990, correct? The self-titled album around 90.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And then the next album is a couple years later, around 92. You mentioned that Ocean Records.
Yep.
Was Ocean Records already established and then bought you guys, or were you familiar with who were the owners of Ocean? Do you know anything about that
No.
situation? You just still were kind of the same. You're like, I'll just sign it and let me play music. That's all. Let the other
Yeah,
guys deal with it.
I was blissfully ignorant. You know, again, I just did not seem to care much about any of
Yeah.
that stuff. I grew to be far more interested in all of that stuff later, but during my tenure of being in Crystal Box, I just, you know, I left that to people who knew what they were doing.
Well, and I was going to ask you, is there anything looking back that you wish you would have invested a little more knowledge or investigating into that time period of maybe I should have been a little more aware of this situation or that, or
Oh,
you
I
just.
think all of it. I mean, you know, at any point in our life, we're only so prepared to handle whatever or only prepared to absorb and interact with so much of our present reality. And at that time, I just did not have the presence of mind to do much more than, you know, have a job, pay my bills, get myself fed, you know, and play guitars, like all that other stuff. That was more on my plate than I could handle with my emotional maturity at that point.
Yeah. And I mean, I could say I was the same when I was trying to make it as a musician back in the day. And I think a lot of people are like that. You know, you're just wanting to get signed and you're not looking to be like, well, how am I going to get screwed when I get signed? You don't think about that part usually,
Yeah.
for the bands that probably dealt with a lot of bad record deals.
Well, I think we all have the same mindset. I mean, that, you know, we were grateful to be saved by a loving God. We had a love of music. We got to put those two passions together and share our music. And there was really no intent to make a living out of it. You know, we're thinking that if for some reason it was going to work out, then there'd be enough money in order to propagate, you know, existence while we're doing that. And it did for a while. And then, you know, but reality was that everybody except for me was starting a new family. They were getting married, having kids, and there was bills paid. You know, it just wasn't there to invest all the time it would have taken to fully launch that. So, you know, whether it was there for a season and, you know, and that was the sum total of the plan or just didn't work out for who unknown reasons, I have no idea. But you know, I'm certainly grateful for that time. We had
Yeah.
great memories and got to meet a lot of fantastic people and hopefully got to share our music with people that it meant something to.
Well, this sounds like you kind of lean up to a question I'm gonna ask, but I do want to hit on, of course, the second record, because you guys only put out the two. Well, the two at the time you put out,
Yep.
but that second one would kind of be your last one there. You also had a guest guitarist on there. Well, I know George Ochoa played on there. Was that because you're friends, you wanted him to come in, or anybody else part of the album? How did that second album going in the studio? Any thoughts, memories, stories about that one?
Yeah, that so I remember we were, let's see, we were that was the second album, The Bottom Line. Ocean Records had this new studio, Ocean Studios, which is a different than the previously established Ocean, but it was a great, a beautiful studio. It was like this old brick building that used to be a former Chrysler automobile dealership that had
Yeah.
been gutted, you know, the shell, and they rebuilt the studio. It had a beautiful console, a nice huge live room, had an amazing sound, nice isolation. They had a great, you know, I mean, it was just a beautiful place and it was brand new. They had just kind of gotten it wrapped up. I believe that right before we got there, they had the guys from Night Ranger kind of running it through his paces. I think it was Brad Gillis and Jeff Watson kind of just doing some stuff, or at least that's the story. I didn't see them myself. We got in there and we started our recording there. We got some of our initial drum tracks and guitar and stuff like that done. I remember we were doing some vocal there as well. I think they had like a great Telefunken mic that Adam was in love with, and it was fun. And then Peter Cetera from Chicago came and toured the facility while we were recording, and he decided the story that I heard that he wanted to record there. And it's like, oh, great, these guys will be done soon. It's like, no, I want to record there now. It's like, okay, guys, you got to go. Yeah. So we got the boot. We went to a studio down the street called Mama Joe's, which is another well-known recording studio. It's now defunct and gone. But it was a tiny little place that had apparently had been involved with lots of historic recordings. So it was fun to be there. Mike Sirocco, I think, was our engineer there. Yeah. And we were there. We had everything kind of written. What we typically did is we were doing the tracking, the bass and the drums, the guitar and the bass. And then by the time we were done with that, we do a rough mix. They put it on a cassette. I would take it home, listen to it, and I wouldn't really try to play anything. I just typically would always listen to a song over and over until I heard pretty much the whole thing in my head, at least in a general framework and outline. Because I'm not a really technical player, and if I try to lead with just what I can do with my fingers, it bores me. Yeah. So I like to imagine things in my head first, and after I've got a picture of something I'm aiming for, then I go figure out how to actually play what I hear in my head. And that's what I did. So I took that and I did all the songs except for this one song that Lauren had written.
Paradise.
So Lauren had read that song, which is kind of a departure from anything that Chris Vox had done previously. Mm-hmm. It was a lot faster and harder. And I had written the intro kind of lead to that. And, I was feeling comfortable with that. But when it came to the actual guitar solo, I wasn't able to think in terms of how that song was progressing and where I wanted to take it. I was literally had no vision of what I wanted to do. And I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity just to bring somebody in just for the fun of it and have them just bring whatever they, bring their talents to the song. So I was more than happy to step aside and let somebody come in. So I gave Oz Fox a call from Striper. I didn't know him.
Really?
Had lots of friends in common. And called him up. And then he said, he was happy to do it. But he also let me know that he belonged to a musicians union and that there was a scale that had to be paid. It wasn't like I can't just do it up, apart from that, because that's kind of the contract of the union in honoring, his commitment there. And I had to pass for that very reason, because we were dead broke. We had no money, no budget.
Do you remember how, out of curiosity, nothing against Oz, but how much that would have cost to have him come in by chance?
I'm sure it wasn't much, but I mean, when I say we had no money, I mean, literal. So it could have been $20 and it would have been outside of our budget,
Yeah. Because I know during that time, Oz was appearing on quite a few albums like Bride.
Oh, yeah.
And Ransom and a bunch of, he was doing quite a bit then. But so Oz was out of the budget.
Mm-hmm. So I knew George from that time, because when I was as I said, when I was going to Sanctuary, sometimes we'd end up over there, at Steve's house during band practice for Recon, or the earlier version of Recon, which was DeRock, I guess that was the name of the band.
Yeah.
And met George then. So I gave George a call and said, hey, dude, would you be interested in coming down and playing? So he was game. And he didn't take long. He got down there, brought his guitar, and he did his thing. He was much more comfortable with that kind of that style of music. I mean, he's used to playing faster. I came more from like a blues background.
Okay.
Slower and, slowly, working on my speed. I wasn't, like I said, a very technical player. So playing at that level or speed was just a little bit outside of my comfort zone.
So when that album comes out, you guys aren't really together much longer after that. Do you even play any shows after that? Or is it kind of wrapping up pretty quickly after the album comes out?
That's a good question. And Fred might remember, because he's got a great memory of those historical events. But I don't remember playing much after that, no.
Yeah.
That was just the time. It was, the strain of everybody having to figure out how to take care of their own financial household. And I know that at that time I met who's going to be my wife. So there was, all that going on. At the same time, I was, finding a new job and trying to keep myself in a house and home.
Do you think that if you guys had been successful making comfortable income, you would have kept going?
For me, I think I would have loved that. Yeah, I mean, I even still, it's like, you know, you kind of accept whatever reality that you're faced with. You know, you shoot, you have your ambitions and your dreams of what you want to do, and you got to take a shot at it, whether it works or not. I mean, that's why there's risk. Risk means you don't know what the outcome is going to be. So we wanted to see that happen, and it worked out for that period of time. So again, sometimes things are only really meant in the grand scheme of what God's plan was to only last for a period of time. And maybe that was really it. You know, one hand you can say it's a failure. You guys never able to go beyond that. Maybe that's true. Maybe it was just that, you know, this is what we had to say at that moment in time. And then there was other things that took precedence, you know, certainly raising their families and sons and daughters. And then now there's a huge clan of, you know, sons and daughters from those four guys. So that's a legacy that we're all certainly proud of.
Well, since that time, what have you done musically with your, I guess, the time frames up until now?
Nothing good.
No. Why is that? Nothing good.
I'm just kidding, man. So after, you know, the second album, I don't know. I think it was Fred's idea to kind of do like the 25-year mix thing, which eventually moved into the 30-year mix. I don't remember. It took a while to get around to kind of remix those things because that, you know, some of those albums had sonic qualities that were popular at that time and didn't necessarily age well.
Right. Know,
the production values and the balance and all that kind of stuff. I had a Pro Tools HD system, which is based around, you know, Mac hardware available to me that I'd bought for other reasons. And, you know, Fred says, hey, let's go ahead, you know, and I also owned a 24-track tape machine. So I transferred all of the tapes to Pro Tools and, you know, the 24-bit 192 kilohertz sampling rate just to save it at the highest possible resolution. And then Fred took that and he had a little studio at his place out there in El Cajon or Poway or somewhere out there. And he started just, you know, putting together the tracks and reconstructing the mixes little by little. And then Fred and Lauren were, you know, assisting that. So he kind of put all that together and then, you know, worked with other entities in order to make those reissues possible.
That's the 20-year mix one that was put out. Is that the album you're talking about where?
Yeah.
Right, it's a couple discs. Then you have a bonus disc.
And then we were trying to just come up with the time in order to write some more material. So we, you know, I had part of a song that we had kind of like halfway fleshed out and somehow I wasn't aware that was going to end up on there because it wasn't really done.
When does the 20-year mix, when did you guys do that and that come out? You remember what year that was?
Not a clue.
Was it actually 20 years after?
It's when it started. Yeah.
Yeah.
It took a couple of years in order to get it wrapped up.
Did you guys put that out yourself or was there any label involved? Because I know Rox reissued some of your stuff, correct?
Yep. That's who they were working with.
Okay.
Yeah.
So outside of Krista Vox, what have you been involved with musically?
Mostly just, I continued doing some writing on my own. You know, I had some recording equipment, so I just write for myself. You know, just because most of my time was involved with, you know, taking care of my family, being involved with my church. And then I played as often as I could, which did not seem to be anywhere near enough. And then for whatever time I did have is either just practicing and keeping your chops up or trying to, and then whenever the inspiration hit, just try to hit record and throw that some ideas, you know, not with a good production value, but just, you know, just to have it so that, you know, when you get some time, you come, you know, circle back around and finish off a song or write additional verses. And Fred kind of was the same thing. Fred got involved with doing his own production at home studio. And he's going at like gangbusters right now. He's just doing all kinds of cool stuff and doing the entire production himself and putting the albums out, you know, under different names. And
Really?
So we've actually been talking. We hang, you know, we keep in contact. And I went out there and visited him where he lives out there in Arkansas. And we got to hang out for a bit and write some music. So we decided, you know, it's kind of fun to do. He's continuing to do his own stuff. And we talked about getting together again and start working on some music again, which wouldn't necessarily have any kind of specific direction. It's just for the love and the fun of writing music.
Yeah. Creative. I want to ask, of course, about the documentary. and it is available on YouTube if anybody wants to watch it. But when did you get approached about that? Were you kind of surprised about, like, we were just a band that had two albums and someone wants to do this video documentary about us? Kind of tell me about that whole situation.
Another name I can't remember. I can see his face, but there, you know, Lauren, and as I mentioned earlier, he had involved with studio production as a recording engineer. And then they all had, Kelly Seagraves. Thank you. Thank you, memory. he had a video production company, and I think it was one of those things. It was just kind of a serendipitous connection of, well, hey, you know, they needed to do something or wanted to do something in the production of a rock video. And of course, Crystal Rocks needed, or, you know, it was kind of working out that they could, you know, tell the story and share kind of like the genesis of what had happened and what the band had gone through. So that's kind of where that came from. I had, you know, nothing to do with it. I think, again, that's another thing that Fred and Lauren and Adam really worked with them, but Kelly Seagraves and his company had taken care of the, you know, the production aspect of it. And we did a concert at Horizon Christian Fellowship in Claremont, San Diego. And that was where they brought in the video equipment, you know, the booms. And we had, I think it was like a New Year's Eve concert or somewhere thereabouts. And, you know, over a night or two, they recorded all that material and edited it together and put out what you can see.
Is there also, if I'm not mistaken, is there clips from when you guys played Cornerstone too on there?
You know, it was the longest time that I've wanted, after we did that, I was like, you know, after about 10 years, I'm going, you know, it'd been cool to be able to see how that went. You know, that was kind of before the internet was really taking off. So mm-hmm. We didn't have any video cameras. We were busy playing on stage. So nobody really recorded it. But apparently a couple of recordings had surfaced, you know, years, if not decades later.
Yeah.
And eventually I did get to see some of those things there online.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about the film, the documentary, after it came out? Were you pretty happy with how everything was presented?
I think it was, you know, it told a story and it got to share kind of where things came from and what our intent was and what God was doing. So yeah, I think for that, you know, that sake alone, certainly.
Did you got what you remember what year you guys did that, or that was put out? Was that around 2009-10 somewhere in there, or later maybe? I couldn't find it. I was trying to find it, but I know it's been out a while. But the reason I was asking is that the last time the four of you guys have been together.
I'm laughing because I'm thinking in retrospect, let me go back. Like, this guy couldn't remember a single thing he did or when he did it.
This is no, trust me, this is common because I talk to people that you don't talk about these stories that often.
No, nope,
and you have don't. To go back in your memories, and trust me, it's normal. I'd have to do the same thing if someone were to ask me stuff about back in the day. But
I think for me, it's not so much, you know, it's certainly not because I wanted to forget about it. It's just that, you know, whatever you're doing, you want to put your heart and soul into it. And then when that's done, you move on to whatever's next.
Yeah.
And what's behind is behind. You're always looking to create a better, if your best days are ever behind you, that's going to be a sad day, right? So we're going to make a better tomorrow in one form or another, whether it be your ambitions or dreams or what it is you think you're going to do or what you're trying to build.
Yeah.
So I was certainly glad to do that. And we had so much fun, and I'm really, really grateful for that entire experience.
And what I was asking on that was just, was that the last time the four of you guys were together in one room, or have you guys gotten to hang out since then?
Yeah. So I think there's probably one additional time that we were able to get together. Perhaps maybe it was at Adam's house, and, you know, just kind of catch up what everybody was doing and recognizing, you know, how the families had grown. We didn't talk much, and I didn't really have much communication with Lauren and Adam. So I pointed out that I did keep in contact with Fred, so I knew what was going on with his family. But there was all kinds of things going on with Lauren and Adam's family that I was unaware of. So it was a good time to catch up, and I think that was probably the last time that all four of us were together.
I know you're in Florida now, is that correct?
I am in Florida.
I've been so
over a year now.
You mentioned that he's in Arkansas. Are the other guys still back in San Diego, or is everyone real spread out?
No, I think that Adam and Lauren are probably living either at the same place or very close to the same place they've been for a while. So, you know, they're had well-established residences there, and I think they're still there.
Kind of closing this out, of course, people would want to know, is there any chance that we would ever hear new music or anything from Chris DeVox? Is there any chance that you guys would be willing to get back together and just maybe put out, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Bill Baffert has mentioned that to you guys from Rocks, but you know, what's your thoughts on that? Or
Well, I mean, I know for me and Fred and I, we certainly love doing that. We certainly like writing songs and just creating. So we're going to continue to do that in one form or another, not necessarily under the Crystal Box banner, but, you know, just doing it. And where that ends up, who knows? You know, I certainly don't want to put a limit or put any, you know, formalities as to what it has to be. It's going to come out and do whatever it is. As far as Lauren and Adam, I think they've got other priorities and interests right now. Maybe at some point they'll return, or maybe they have those interests now. I don't know. So as far as doing the Crystal Box thing again, I don't, it seems unlikely. And I don't, you know, have anything against or not wanting to do that, but it seems pretty unlikely just because of the amount of coordination, either physical locations, logistics, and it seems unlikely, but who knows?
The music you're creating now, how, is there a certain style or
That's just
you
it.
would
It
kind
doesn't
of.
have to. I mean, it can be all over. It doesn't have to be cohesive. It doesn't have to necessarily fit under the umbrella of, well, these have to be homogenous enough in order to fit on an album. This is like, I mean, I'm being ridiculous, but if I were to say that if one was going to be metal and the other one's going to be country, so be it. You know, it's not, but.
I got you. Anything else musically that might be happening with you coming out, or is just this pretty much just going with the flow kind of thing that you're doing now?
You know, it's hard. I will continue to write and play because I enjoy doing that. I'm always surprised when there are people who are interested in hearing that, honestly. I mean, not it's not humility, it's not false humility. It's a surprise. I mean, you know, there are so many fantastic, talented musicians out there. There's certainly no lack of good music out there. And if people are interested and we're able to find a place in order to be able to distribute that, then, you know, hopefully that those two roads can meet up. But I don't have any formal plans of doing anything other than doing as much as I can do it. You know, I'm looking forward. You know, now that we're living here in Florida and I've got a little bit of space in order to be able to get my stuff set up and then leave it set up so there's less involved with actually starting a recording process. I can really imagine that more things are going to be coming out of my mind and onto tape in the next, you know, coming months. But, and I know that Fred's kind of in the same situation. You know, he certainly got his gig going, but he makes a priority of putting his writing time every week and getting songs out. And, you know, he'll send me mixes and, you know, I get to listen to whatever he's doing, you know, the latest production. So it's kind of fun.
Well, that's cool. I mean, Tony, I appreciate you joining the podcast and kind of going down what you could of memory lane. You know,
Right.
it's because it, people haven't heard from you guys in a while, and it's always interesting to get your stories out there for people to hear. So, you guys had some great music out there, and I still appreciate the music you guys created and still listen to it.
I'm glad to hear
And
it.
I always let my guests have the last word. They want to say anything to fans, listeners. I'll leave it with you, the last word.
Oh, wow. Oh, I appreciate that. You know, I suppose really, you know, why we started doing this is because, you know, our lives were transformed by the sacrificial blood of Jesus, who had saved us from, you know, the lives that we were living. And as a result of that, you know, our lives were saved. We were promised heaven, but we were also promised a life in this world and abundantly, and being able to share our faith with others because we want everybody to be able to experience the free gift that God made available. That's still what I'm hoping to do with my life. I want to, you know, whether it's through music or through the work of my hands or whatever I'm doing, hopefully that's what I'll be able to accomplish with whatever days I've got left. So if there's any music coming forthcoming, you know, it'll certainly be an expression of who God created us to be. You know, he's a creative God. What he created is creative. And you know, so that's really where I'm coming from, and hopefully where I'm headed, just to continue to see the name of Jesus spoken, so that more people can be freed from death. We're all sinners, and God's God is a loving God who is slow to anger, quick to forgive, and He will change the most twisted life, which I would call my life at that time when I met Him, pretty twisted. And He can make something amazing out of it. And that's kind of what He does.